We present the news quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
Hello and welcome to the news quiz. We start with a headline from the Bournemouth Echo, read by Susan Ray.
Stolen prosthetic arm discovered in second-hand shop.
Our thanks to Mark Williams for sending that in. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Jeremy Hardy and Samira Ahmed. And opposite them on my left, Rufus Hound and Hugo Rifkin. Jeremy, which moving ceremony was mostly selfie-serving?
Well, before we move on to the star of the occasion, David Cameron, I've just got one complaint about Mandela Week, which is that I am getting heartily sick of hearing people say, Mr. Mandela's greatest achievement was his capacity to forgive. Because I'm thinking, no, that's not his greatest achievement. His greatest achievement was overthrowing you buggers. And the fact that he didn't then force you to spend the rest of your lives cleaning every toilet in Soweto with your own toothbrushes is frankly disappointing. But in a spirit of forgiveness, let's move on. The star of the occasion was, of course, our own Prime Minister, who needs to be forgiven because he went on a sanctions-busting jolly to apartheid South Africa in 1988. But let's not harp on about that. David, who went on a sanctions-busting jolly to apartheid South Africa in 1988. What happened was the Danish Prime Minister wanted a picture taken with someone very, very famous and popular. David Cameron made a big mistake at this point. I've made the same mistake. I've hung around with some very famous people. I've worked a lot with Jack D, and I learned very early on. People come up and they say, hey, guys, can I get a picture? And I'd say, yes, of course. And they'd say, OK, well, if you could just press that button and look through there. And our own Prime Minister made the self-same mistake, craning into the picture, and she's just thinking, look, I want a picture with the famous one that people like.
But is there not something about the possibility that Cameron wanted the picture with Obama because it's the second time he's met a black man and he wanted photographic evidence this time?
It would be an excellent way, though, generally, to sort of blag into any kind of sort of world event by just pretending to be the Danish Prime Minister. Getting almost anywhere.
Yeah. Are you suggesting the whole world doesn't know who the Danish Prime Minister is?
Sandy, until this week, I thought you were the Danish Prime Minister.
The only thing that really annoyed me about all of that coverage was they kept calling it a selfie. And it was her selfie, it was Hella's selfie. Mm. But Cameron wasn't in a selfie. A selfie is a picture you take of yourself.
So were they saying he took
a selfie? He was just in a photograph.
Yeah.
Like, there's two ways to take a selfie. One is the way you saw Hella doing it, which is you sort of contort your hand into that weird claw where you've got to touch the touch screen and sort of aim it. And the other way is just to stand near a mirror and take it that way. And David Cameron can't do that one either, because that requires a reflection.
It's much easier just to take a picture of your genitalia, I find. Because then you just point downwards and it's just all very straightforward.
But awkward during a memorial service, I
think. Depends what you're commemorating.
The guy who was the signer claimed he saw angels.
Yes, he did, yeah. He said that he wasn't feeling entirely well.
Based on how angry he's made the deaf community, I don't think it'll be that long till he is seeing angels.
I think he was playing the sign language version of news bingo. So that's when someone says, Samira, why don't you work the word custard creams into the news quiz? And I go, OK, I'll have a go.
Right.
And they obviously said, you know, you've got Obama giving a big speech. Can you work in the moves to YMCA? Macarena? Walk like an Egyptian? And in that sense, it was a great success.
But isn't the really odd thing that, like, they've given what he was doing to sign language experts and they say there's not even a trace of sign language in it. It's not just that he was bad at it, it's that he doesn't know any sign language at all.
No.
I'll tell you how little sign language this bloke knew. He was in the same room as Tony Blair, George W. Bush, Robert Mugabe and Jacob Zuma, right? Now, I don't know any sign language, but even I could come up with a couple of hand gestures.
Everyone talked about how Obama was the star turn, but it was a bit rich when he said some people just getting in on the bandwagon and that some world leaders need to question whether they are actually acting in the spirit of Mandela. And he said that he wanted Mandela to make him better. And I thought, I don't know if that means he wants his drone strikes to be more accurate or if he's just going to be less trigger happy in future.
Well, he did. Obama challenged his fellow world leaders to search their souls. Wow, awkward.
Maybe someone had trodden in something.
World leaders gathered in Soweto on Tuesday to pay their respects to possibly the greatest politician of the 20th century. Nelson Mandela fought for decades against the terrible injustice of apartheid, becoming South Africa's first black president, but he still couldn't stop Bono turning up to praise him. It was the biggest gathering of the great and the good and Tony Blair for decades.
I'm glad that you mispronounced Bono, because it's exactly what he deserves. Bono once wrote a letter to Frank Zappa asking if he would collaborate musically, and Frank Zappa just wrote a note saying, "Dear Bongo, no."
2 points to Jeremy. Rufus, listen to this. Rufus, who might be losing their faculties over segregation?
Well, if you ever felt that Britain was a forward-looking sort of a place, it's delightful to realise in the same week we mourn a man who famously ended segregation, British universities are quite keen to bring it back. There's recommendations from on high. I forget, what's the name of the...
Universities UK.
Universities UK, who've said that if you have a speaker coming to your university who says that they can't possibly speak in a room where men and women are being treated equally, then it's fine that you don't. And that, and apparently we're all fine with that.
Well, I don't think we're all fine with that. I think they're trying to find a way of balancing the Equalities Act of 2012, which promises equal opportunities, and the Education Act of 1986, which says that university premises mustn't bar anybody on the grounds of their belief or radical extremists or the Bullingdon Club or something. I mean, you have to...
Yeah.
At our local gym at Virgin Active, they have segregated changing rooms.
Do they?
They do. As a protest, I wear my burqa into the ladies' changing rooms every day, and everyone's fine with it.
But if you impose segregation, then some male students won't talk to a female until the workplace. Or if they join the cabinet, even then...
Sadly, when I was at university, actually, my room had very few women in it, and I did consider this to be a real problem. But where were the bloody feminists then?
You should have come to my room. There was no problem at all.
I did wonder, though, there's 180 examples where this took place. I thought this was just one of those things, a bit of a storm in a teacup. Is it really that big a deal? But 180 occasions where that took place between March 2012 and March this year... How many radical clerics are there that they're getting that many bookings? Like, I assumed like maybe you're going to get one of those guys working the circuit, but if there's 180, like the comedy stuff, I'll be honest, has kind of dried up for me recently. Should I be considering radical cleric? It does mean not talking to women and not drinking.
No, you can talk to women, they just have to sit outside covered in a tarpaulin.
Yeah. It's about the right to self-organise. I mean, I do think it is a real hot potato, which in no way, can I say, implies that I'm biased against cold potatoes. I believe potatoes should be able to choose their own temperature and apologise if I've caused any offence to the potato community in any way. Official guidelines from Universities UK, which represents those who run British universities, is facing a backlash from student bodies for, in some instances, permitting gender segregation on campuses. The problem of how you accommodate an audience, half of whom want to be segregated and half of whom don't, has provided universities with a real headache, and physics departments with a very good quantum mechanics problem. Now, the whole subject is a grey area, which is, of course, where the mature students are forced to sit. 2 points to Rufus. Samira, listen to this. Doctor, can't you see I'm burning? Samira, who has dished the dirt on doctors.
There's been new, I think, government commissioned research into 1,000 GP surgeries, and they apparently went for the ones they thought there might be a problem in and found that a third of them had something seriously wrong, like maggots or out-of-date vaccines, which then wouldn't actually be vaccinating you against anything.
Well, there was a wonderful quote. Chief Inspector of General Practice, Professor Steve Field, said, "Patients not correctly immunised could later become very, very poorly and then die." It's amazing what they know about medicine.
I knew it was a bit of a risk the last time I went to get a flu inoculation, and the bloke opened the top of the syringe and went, "Does that smell all right to you?"
There was a surgery in Leeds that was found to have no GPs. Now, surely the this is the future. You know, like those self-service tills at Tesco, do you not think? Unexpected protrusion in abdominal area. Please remove.
Does this not scare anyone, though? Like, there are a lot of stories coming out at the moment about all the ways the NHS is failing. At the same time, there's privatisation by stealth. Now, if you're a conspiracy theorist, maybe those two things just sort of resolve themselves. But if you're a normal person, you've got to sort of become a conspiracy theorist. The number of contracts being put out to private companies has gone up through the roof. All of the pre-election promises of no privatisation of the NHS and that the budget would be ring-fenced. It was ring-fenced, but not in real terms. So it is a cut in the truest sense. The NHS is being sold out from under us. And yet all the stories that come out from the powerful oligarchs who run the media are either about how it's failing, how much better off we'd be if it was privatised, or why privatisation can't happen quickly enough for any one of a number of other reasons. Like the reason those surgeries are filthy is because there's not the investment to keep them clean and tidy. The argument isn't privatise, the argument is invest more. Like in the Olympics, there was that big moment where they had NHS and everybody stood up and applauded. I think it was Norma Lamont said, the nearest thing British people have to a religion is the NHS. And we're just letting it go. People should be on the streets. And I realise... and I realise, for this to make the edit, it should have a punchline.
No, but it gave me a nice quiet moment, so I enjoyed it.
Basically, it is all pretty much privatised. We're just bankrolling it because it's broken up into different sort of competing economic units. When it was started, the whole point was a big, fat, angry Welshman rounded up all the doctors in the country. Right, you bastards, go out there and make people better. And they all did as they were told. And now it's just like Selfridges. You go in there and half of it's not even Selfridges. There's Paco Rabanne and Levi's and all sorts of concessions in there. We need a big, fat, angry Welshman running it again. That's what I say. Bryn Terfel.
The first national inspection of more than 900 GP surgeries in England by the Quality Care Commission has found one in three is failing to meet basic standards. The health inspectors turned up at the surgeries without an appointment, so had to wait 8 hours to be seen. Maggots were found at two surgeries, although by the time the doctor actually got around to seeing them, they'd turned into blue bottles. Dr. Maureen Baker, chair of the Royal College of GPs, said, breaches of procedure cannot be condoned even if they are isolated incidents. Now, excuse me, there seems to be something crawling up my leg. 2 points to Samira. Hugo, why is education less about throwing money around and more about tossing a coin?
This is Sir Michael Wilshaw, who is the chief inspector of schools. In his annual report card for schools, he said, what makes a child go to a good school or a bad school? He says, it's all luck. And there's no longer really a link that if you live in a wealthy area, you'll necessarily go to a good school. Or if you live in a sort of like troubled bit of inner city, you'll go to a bad school. And it's a bit weird because he says this like it's a bad thing. But surely you want it to be luck. Surely that's the best way to decide. Because any other way, you're doing it on the basis of something else, which would be worse than luck.
Well, you're going to find the best teachers are in the toughest schools, aren't you? Because well, you've got to be a brilliant teacher to teach. I like the film To Sir With Love with Sidney Poitier. If Sidney Poitier had been working at Cheltenham Ladies College, that would have been a fairly rubbish film.
But Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society is the exception that proves that rule. Of course.
Oh, yeah.
What about Miss Jean Brodie? She, what was that? What school was that? That was a posh girls' school.
That was Hogwarts.
Oh, yeah.
But I was thinking, if it is all about luck, then shouldn't you make it luck all the way through life? So you could have, like, a tombola. You stick your hand in the bran tub every year, and you pull out, ooh, I've got a C and two Ds, and so I'll get to go to Cambridge and be Prince Edward, or I'm professor of endocrinology at, you know, UCL for this year.
Testing is all rubbish anyway. I mean, just let people make up their results and then wing it and then give them the chance, you know, give them a scalpel, give them some marigolds and say, have a go.
That's the NHS.
He's not well anyway. He's unconscious. He's not going to know. See what you can make of this. And, you know, if it doesn't pan out, well, you can try catering.
He also said that schools have got this growing problem, he said, of disobedience. You know, that teachers are finding it harder and harder to control classes and they're letting more things go. He sort of described it, he said it was an endemic problem of, he said, background chatter, inattention and horseplay. And I sort of thought, if they're playing with their horses, this is a fairly niche demographic we're talking about, isn't it?
They are. That is Cheltenham Ladies' College.
But he also, Sir Michael, also drew attention to the plight of white working class boys, saying this group was being left behind. And I thought about that. That is probably true, because we no longer have the two main industries that they would be heading for, which is mining and ballet.
Oh, do you know something? They call Osborne the oik in cabinet, because he only went to St Paul's in London.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and his family were trade. Even though he's an aristocrat, his money's from wallpaper.
Well, you know, I have a friend who was at Eton, same time as David Cameron, and whose parents were university lecturers, and he was called Pleb because he was so lower class, apparently.
Really?
They'd spent all their money to send him to Eton so he could get called Pleb.
Wow, was the person calling him that a policeman? In his latest Ofsted report, Chief Inspector Sir Michael Wilshaw says the uneven quality of schools across the country means England is a nation divided into lucky and unlucky children, much like China is a nation divided into lucky and female children. Some of the wealthier areas have worse performing schools. It's almost as if having money isn't a signifier of intelligence. Sir Michael also warned of poor discipline in the classroom, calling it a culture of casual acceptance of low-level disruption and poor attitudes to something or other, to be honest, I wasn't really listening. Before we start round two, here's an offer spotted on the Amazon website.
The future Mrs. Tom Daly keyring was £4.99. Now 89 pence.
Thanks to Anil McCandy for sending us that. I so want to buy one now. Jeremy, who might be taking gratuities with annuities?
Oh, God. This is insurance. And, of course, we have a problem with an ageing population. And one way to deal with that is to publish newspaper articles about insurance and annuities so that people just lose the will to live. And I just think, do you know what? I don't want to understand what annuities are. I would rather work 40 hours a week until I'm 85 than listen to a single episode of Moneybox. If I had...
But luckily, Jeremy, that is actually government policy.
Exactly. I'm just going to be a burden to people. That's what I'm going to do.
Would you like me to explain annuities?
No, because I will just top myself.
No, it's really simple. Let's imagine that you put all your money into a bag and you give it to me, OK? And then I keep it and don't have to worry about a pension. That's pretty much how it works. Okay.
What they should do, the law should be, once you reach retirement age, you're allowed to steal. That's the only thing that makes any sense. Because, you know, supermarkets, they can deal with a bit of petty theft. You know, you've already done it. When you think how much they throw away at the end of the day. Because old people, they don't have big appetites. Just a couple of fish fingers and a few peas at lunchtime and maybe an omelette, some Werther's Originals. One of those will last my dad a week, a Werther's Original.
I used to think the thing to do was just to keep your money under the mattress. But you know, when you get older and you get bladder problems, the thing is, there's not many shops take papier-mâché.
What we're going to have is a massive old-age crime wave in about 10 years. Young people aren't going to know what's hit them because old people are going to be out on their scooters basically running down young people and robbing them. Young people have got all this money. You see young people around with money and phones and things and jetpacks and skateboards and time travel equipment, eating, you know, eating huge buckets of stuff out of chicken cottage. Young people are really rich. And when I get to 65, I'm going to take them down.
You think the police are going to turn up and go, how did it happen? And the young person's going to go, well, officer, it just all happened so slowly.
Do you think, Jeremy, you and I could be the next Bonnie and Clyde? You ring the bell, do 10 minutes of your act, keep them busy, I'll pop round the back and get in through the cat flap.
I will just tell people anecdotes to lull them. I'll go up to young people and say, do you know what time the next bus is coming, young man? And they'll say, I don't know, innit? Or something, as the young people say. And I'll say, I used to work with Samira Ahmed, you know, many years ago, you probably don't remember. And after a few minutes, they'll slump into a deep coma and I'll nick their chicken bucket. That's how Barry Cryer lives.
Oh, A report by the Financial Services Consumer Panel, those crazy party animals, has called for an investigation into the excessive profits the insurance industry makes from annuities, comparing the tactics used to sell them as tantamount to burglary. According to the Daily Telegraph, the process starts with a wake-up pack sent to savers months before their named retirement age, in which pages of often unintelligible information packaged in unhelpful ways baffle even the well-informed. Oh, no, wait a minute, that is the Telegraph. Sorry, that's... my mistake. 2 points to Jeremy. Samira, who has been left with a red face as well as a red nose?
Oh, this is the investigation into charities, I think, including Comic Relief, finding that they've been investing some of their funds in things like tobacco, alcohol and arms. So kind of going to rename... Red Nose Day, Black Lung Day, possibly, or Red Exit Wound Day, it's another. Because we have to remember, cluster bombs are no laughing matter, unless, of course, you're cluster bombing clowns.
I want that on a T-shirt.
Yes. I always get confused by this. I always thought Sport Relief was some kind of dodgy massage. I didn't really understand it. It was all reported on Panorama, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah, but remember the spaghetti harvest? Do you know what I mean?
I think they just need to own it. Okay, it's come out, fine, move on. Because they already brand everything else, don't they? You can get Comic Relief T-shirts, Comic Relief cookbooks, everything's got Comic Relief tie.
What, just Comic Relief bombs?
Well, exactly. Are you telling me the people of Afghanistan wouldn't rather see a lovely jet fighter, big red nose on the front... Lenny Henry peering down at them. Awooga!
Actually, no, you've got a point, because war is no more horrific than a special celebrity edition of The Office with David Cameron, David Beckham, Prince William, and who's somebody else? Gok Wan, is it?
Well, the chief executive of Comic Relief, Kevin Cahill, he defended the actions, claiming that ethical investments would generate a smaller return. And I do know a bit what he means. Have you tried those fair trade tea bags? It is impossible to get a second cup out of them.
What I don't understand is, why don't they just spend the money rather than invest it? I mean, and they're good people, the Comic Relief, but they've got all this money, and there's people desperate in Syria, in refugee camps in Lebanon. Why don't they just help them instead of thinking, how can we make money out of our money?
There is a slight side of this that does make sense, and if nobody says it, I'll just feel bad. You don't have to put it in, but it is true. The way that they have to stagger giving out the money means that rather than just giving a big chunk of money to somebody saying, get on with it, they give them a little bit, but they have to put the rest of what they're going to give them to one side. So there's a lot of money being held because it's already been divvied up for those projects. And then if you're tied into how they're all tied in legally, you have to have that money make money. Like, there's a thing, like a legal responsibility that is
invested
properly.
You've fallen into that whole buying a man a fishing rod thing, haven't you?
No. But
you've got a fishing rod? No, you've got a Waitrose.
What Comic Relief?
You don't have to invest it in dodgy things. There was over 300,000 invested in alcohol concerns, 3 million on tobacco.
Yeah, but there's a legal...
Heavens, it sounds like Nigel Farage bar bill.
But there's a legal responsibility that you have to... There has to be, like... It's like corporations. Corporations have to be recognised as individuals. They have a legal responsibility to their shareholders to make as much money as possible. There is no moral line. All of those big companies operate psychopathically because they are legally required to do so. And the thing that Comic Relief at least said about all of this coming to light was, we would love to do it another way, but we aren't allowed to. And I believe them because they aren't shits.
Comic Relief has come under fire following a Panorama programme revealing it invested money in managed funds with shares in tobacco, alcohol and arms firms. Comic Relief is a charity founded by Richard Curtis and Lenny Henry, designed to provide much-needed hope to desperate comedians everywhere. A bit like Radio 4. Hugo, who is no longer secure enough to play tag?
Oh, the people who used to put the tags on criminals. There are allegations that G4S have been claiming money from the government for tagging people who were either already in jail or dead. They're not allowed to do that anymore, so they've given the contract to, I think, Capita, and Capita are going to tag them instead.
I don't mind tagging people who are already dead. You can't be too prepared for the zombie uprising. I think this is
it reminded me, actually, when my parents got their dog many years ago, they've got this kind of sort of big open garden, and what they did is they gave my dog basically a tag, which was a kind of electric collar thing.
Well, I've seen those, so they can't leave. Yeah.
Well, you see, it was sort of good for the dog, but what it meant was you take him for a walk and you'd take it off
and you'd put it in your pocket. And then you'd come back, you know, sort of an hour later with your hands stuffed deep in your pockets and this little plastic thing with the two bits of metal on it right down the side of a gentleman's area. And then you'd step over the line and you'd get quite the shock.
But in fairness, you have stopped barking.
Yeah. I'm not knocking it. It was actually quite lovely.
The prison reform campaigners, the Howard League, described the fact that we're still allowing private companies to hold security contracts as surreal. I didn't know that. I thought the Howard League have come a long way from Don't You Want Me, Baby, haven't they?
If only we had some sort of public sector in this country where we pay taxes to the government. I don't know, it sounds like some crazy dream.
Well, I just put you at your ease. Jeremy Serco also manages the UK Atomic Weapons Establishment. But G4S seem to cock up every job that they're given, do they not?
They've and A4E, anything with letters and numbers in it. Never give it to them.
Perhaps they should join with RBS and consolidate all their cock-ups into one enormous fiasco. Security firms G4S and Serco are to be stripped of their contracts to electronically tag criminals following fraud allegations over the way they charged the government by tagging people who were either dead or in jail. The Ministry of Justice asked the G4S accountant to explain himself, but it turned out he'd been dead since 1986. If the companies are found to have committed fraud, then their managers will be sent to jail, or at very least taken halfway to jail and then accidentally released. 2 points to Jeremy, and at the end of round two, the scores are Jeremy and Samir have got 9 points, but Rufus and Hugo are still in the lead with 11. We start round three with a sign spotted on a toilet cubicle door at the University of Aberystwyth.
Please note that to conserve power, the lights in this facility are motion sensitive.
Well, thanks to Stephen Kingston for sending us that. Jeremy, why can we now pronounce you Hubbard and wife?
Oh, God. Well, the Church of Scientology, we've got to be very, very careful what we say about them, because they kill people who disagree with them. They're a funny lot, fair play. But, you know, I mean, religions are quite wacky anyway. I mean, people say, but it's not a proper religion, like the one where the lady has a baby without having done it with the man and it's really God's fault. Whereas Scientology is just sort of self-help with added bonkersness, really. You do a personality test and they say you haven't got one, become a Scientologist. Basically, gay male film stars go to become... crime to be gay. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being a gay male film star.
Have anybody in particular in
mind?
Well,
no. but they're great, and it's a religion that I greatly respect. because they do a lot of important work with the gullible.
But we haven't actually covered the real story.
Oh, yet. They can now get married, and that means that it's been recognised as a religion, and that means it gets tax breaks, which is worrying because it's vastly, vastly wealthy because gay male film stars give it money.
It's more than that, because if it's a religion, then you can ask for universities to segregate audiences because it's your religious beliefs between, like, aliens and non-aliens.
Oh, because that's it, isn't it? Aren't we aliens?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is why I don't think it's a problem that they can now hold weddings and stuff, because the sort of theology of Scientology is that there was Xenu, who's this sort of 75-million-year-old alien, not to be confused with Xena, who was the warrior princess. But he brought billions of people to Earth,
right,
and stacked them around volcanoes and then blew them up. So as we wander now through life, the souls of our long-dead relatives stick to us and bring us down, which does sound quite a lot like a wedding.
And or cellulite.
It's a bit deranged. Worrying that a very science fiction-y sounding religion was created by a science fiction writer, isn't it? It's like hearing that the story of the feeding of the 5,000 was written by someone who works for Pret-a-Manger.
I'd quite like to go to a Scientology wedding, though. Because I've been to all the ones where the bride walks in and it's dan, dan, da, da. It'd be quite nice to go to one where the bride walked into... bom, 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 bom.
Louise Hodkin and Alessandro Calcioli have won their fight to marry in a Church of Scientology chapel after the Supreme Court ruled it was a valid place of meeting for religious worship. The couple haven't set a date yet, as they're still waiting for the chief lizard to RSVP. In 1970, the High Court ruled that Scientology services were not acts of worship, as no one was left feeling guilty or ashamed of their sexuality. Scientology was founded by science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard and based on a rejected script for Blake 7. 2 points to Jeremy. Samira, why is your unhappiness written in the stars?
As a Gemini, I found this incredibly confusing. But I think researchers have been looking at how people behave after they read their horoscopes, researchers in Maryland. And as I say, I don't really quite understand it, but apparently people who believe in astrology tend to be more prone to kind of erratic and sort of reckless decisions. And I was thinking of, who's that actress, Naomi Watts? Who, remember, she played Diana, who was very famously into astrology, and she said, I consulted Diana, I consulted psychics, and clearly made the reckless decision to make that really awful film about her.
Well, I think it only goes to show the dead do have a sense of humour.
That's why we should tag them.
It seems to be kind of circular logic, this, though, because it starts from a very kind of sort of science prejudice, because it basically says that people who read their horoscopes, if the horoscopes says they're going to be like wacky and crazy and do something irresponsible, they then will. This is what the survey says. But the other interpretation would just be that the horoscope was right.
But you know what?
I don't think it was that. I think what it was is if you read your horoscope and it said something negative was going to happen to you, then you so believed something negative was going to happen to you that you decided to be irresponsible. And just
but that's that's the negative thing. That's how clever it is.
Yeah, but you know what options they gave them? It was like you could stay in and clean your house, or you could go to a party. And they seemed surprised that people would choose to go to a party anyway rather than stay. Because staying at home to clean your house would be the logical thing to do, apparently, if you've got a bad horoscope.
But how much can you blame your star signs? Oh, I'm sorry I slept with your sister, but I'm a Taurian. Actually, I did use that once as an excuse.
I think you're right, though. I think it is cyclical. Yes, that's the word. I had a real mental block there. It's cyclical because...
Say it again, because he can edit it. Honestly, it's fantastic.
I mean, I said circular, but whatever.
No, well, yeah, maybe it is circular.
Say allegedly.
It's astrology makes you behave badly, but maybe it's people who are already going to behave badly are the people who read horoscopes.
Ah.
Right? It's all looking at the stars, right? There was a big bang that was 13.8 billion years ago. All matter and energy exploded into being. The Milky Way only came into being 600 million years after that. And even now, balls of hydrogen are building new elements at temperatures of millions of degrees that are currently moving into what used to be nothing at 71 kilometres per second. And what this means is that if you were born in March, today's a good day to buy a hat.
But they're never that specific.
And if you believe that, there's a reasonable chance you're going to behave badly because you are mentally subnormal.
They're always just vague enough to be believable, aren't they, horoscopes? They never say anything specific, like today at around 11:30, someone will come up to you and stick a pickled onion in your left nostril. It always just says, you know... So people read their horoscopes and they go, oh, wow, that's incredible. I mean, I am underappreciated in my workplace.
But it can't be specific, Jeremy, because it's a 12th of all people. It can't be a 12th of all people are going to meet a dark, handsome stranger who's going to put a gherkin up their nose. It's not... I don't believe in the stars, honestly, which is why it was such a strange choice to head up the Danish space programme.
I once met a Sagittarian. He only ate goats.
How's it going, the Danish space programme?
What, the Danish space programme?
Yeah.
I think they may have chosen me, if I'm honest. It was something to do with the small capsule.
Tricky getting all the way into space in just Lego.
Yeah, but you'd have no problems if you suddenly thought, oh, it's a bit small. I'll rebuild. A study in the Journal of Consumer Research showed that those who believed their fate could change were more prone to erratic decision-making. The study by the University of South Carolina and Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore unmistakably concluded that American academics have money to burn. 37% of the public read their horoscopes before making big decisions. Personally, I make it a rule not to base any decisions on an unsubstantiated piece of advice. But then again, I'm a Taurian and we're very practical. The psychic industry in the UK is worth an estimated £100 million. Estimated? Don't they? Surely they know. Seems a bit silly. 2 points to Samira. Rufus, why is it beginning to look a lot like Weihnachten?
Yes, it was reported this week that apparently we're all going German at Christmas. I don't really know the point of this story. Because, like, Christmas is already bloody German, yeah. If you think about it.
Yeah.
There's a superior white man who sits at the top of the world deciding who's been good and who's been bad and uses slave labour to reward the faithful. And he doesn't include the Jews. Feels pretty German already.
Do you know, Hitler had a very depressing Christmas tree. Only had one bauble.
Lots of countries have really weird Christmas stuff. This, like, I don't know, maybe it's the same in Denmark actually, but Sweden has a goat.
Yeah, we don't. The Swedes drink more than the Danes. We don't have the goat.
Bring presents. What
I don't know. The Yule book, it's called. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, we don't have that. But honestly, they're off their heads, the Swedes. So. When my son was about 5, he wanted to dress up as Father Christmas, and we couldn't find an outfit. He was a tiny little boy. So I made him, took me days and days and days, a proper Father Christmas outfit and a little Hessian sack and so on. And so Christmas Eve we celebrate, and I dressed him up, and I said, now go out there with all the presents and say ho, ho, ho. And he said, I can't. I said, why? He said, if I speak, they'll know I'm not the real Father Christmas. That's a very good point. And it was a little silent boy went out nodding at everybody. The spread of German Christmas markets and the huge surge in sales of Stollen mean that this year the UK is going to see its most German Christmas ever. Stollen was traditionally baked in the 15th century to celebrate the overturning of a ban on butter in Advent by Pope Innocent, the inventor of the fruit smoothie. This year, Waitrose are selling a special Stollen created by Heston Blumenthal, which tastes like sprouts and comes served as a mist. I've no idea. Glühwein is German for wine that tastes like Pritstick. It's my show. I can say what I bloody like. 2 points to Rufus. Hugo, listen to this.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long du golfe clair a des reflets d'argent. La mer.
How sexy was that, wasn't it? Charles Trenet. He might be Charlie Trenant, for all I know. I don't know, but it's lovely. Hugo, who's bored of bad manners au bord de la mer?
The French.
2 points. So...
there is a cafe in Nice, and they've got a sign outside that's kind of been sort of gone viral, been reported around the world. And what it says on this sign, if you ask for a coffee, on cafe, is €7. But if you say, en café, s'il vous plaît, it's only €4.25. And if you say, bonjour, en café, s'il vous plaît, it's €1.40. So basically, the idea is that this cafe is rewarding people for being nice, encouraging nice behaviour. Although, another way of looking at it is that it only costs €4.50 to be an arsehole Frenchman. Which seems like quite a good deal to me. What I also liked about this story, because I'm obviously a journalist and deal normally in the written word, is it's a campaign to be nice in Nice, although that's much better written down.
No, but that is pleasing, isn't it? I hate all that ordering in cafes. I get very confused. I resolutely always say black coffee, and they always say, do you want milk with that? Oops, why can't we use the good old British cappuccino or espresso? I don't know what's the matter with it. That's very irritating. Would this work in Britain? It would be cheaper if it was... If you were polite, more polite?
I think it should be whether you're grammatically correct.
To get points for grammar.
Give them if they say less when they should say fewer, they have to pay double.
I know my audience.
Only on Radio 4 would that get a smattering of applause.
Yeah, clap now, you're not going to last the winter.
Uh, A French Riviera cafe has caused a stir by rewarding polite customers with cheaper coffee. Customers who asked for un café were charged €7. Customers who said bonjour un café s'il vous plaît were charged €1.40. And those who said stick your hands up, this is a robbery, got one for free. The proprietor said he first got the idea from the way French cafes have been overcharging British customers for years. The story, which appeared on the Nice Matin Facebook page, has received 60,000 likes, 70,000 j'adore, and 80,000 bouf. So that's 2 points for a correct answer. Can I just say, God, Sandy, you look wonderful today. Would have got you 4 points. And for 8 points, I would have accepted all hail my Danish quiz master overlord. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along. Ms. Ahmed.
This is one from someone called Alison. It's like a notice that was on a tree. Found in the Matlock area late at night on Saturday the 22nd. Grey tabby cat. Sadly, this cat is now deceased.
Mr. Rifkin.
This is sent in by Fergus McGarvey. And it's from the New Ross Standard in Ireland. And it begins, an event of great significance and solemnity took place at the Clochban Public House in Clonroch. The Game Preservation Association celebrated the start of the winter shooting season. The annual competition rewards and celebrates the person who bags the most impressive male pheasant. And Jack Harris from Castlebrough was hailed as the member with the longest cock.
Mr. Hound.
This is from Maurice McSweeney. Spotted on the welcome boards of the Westwood Club in Coventry. The Westwood Centre today welcomes the Alzheimer's Society to their dinner and dance. Don't forget the Christmas raffle at the bar.
Let's take a look at the final score. Jeremy and Samira have got 13 points, but this week's winners are Rufus and Hugo with 15. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from the KLM airline website spotted by Daniel Yang.
On KLM flights, we do not offer Wi-Fi yet. But this year, starting with one of our Boeing 777 aircraft, we're introducing Wi-Fi on board as a pilot.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Samira Ahmed, Rufus Hound and Hugo Rifkin. In the chair was Sandy Toksvig, and the news was read by me, Susan Ray. The chair's script was written by John Hunter, Stephen Carlin, Roderick Crooks and Simon Littlefield, with additional material by Annie Birchall and Gráinne Maguire. The producer was Sam Michel.